Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my mother and co-host, Caroline Kilborn. Hi, Mom.
Hello, everyone. Hi. My voice is kind of bad because my, you know, thingy, but but I just wanted to be part of this today because it is an amazing book. Amazing book.
Well, why don't you introduce our author?
Okay. Our author is Christina Adams. And the book is Camel Crazy. Now, Christina is an award-winning author of the memoir A Real Boy. As a journalist, she speaks on autism, writing, culture, and camels. Her work has been featured by National Public Radio, The Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, Gulf News, Dubai One, and many more. She lives in Orange County, California. And I can't tell you, wow, amazed I was by the revelation of this, the camels things, and I just hope everybody who needs this can find out about it. I really do.
And the title of the book is Camel Crazy, A Quest for Miracles in the Mysterious World of Camels. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Christina.
Thank you, Monica and Caroline. I'm very pleased to join you today.
So, Mom, you had some comments about, you know, how surprised you were to find out all of these things about camels.
Well, you know, I mean, they have been around in the history of the world, it seems like forever. And then all at once here they are helping something that's in our culture is devastating to families who have children who have autism. And it's just, I'm just so pleased that this woman has found this out and then shared it with the world. I mean, that's the important thing, that she's sharing it. Because, like I say, there's so many families that are, you know, that have this, and they have there's no cure, and there's just nowhere to go. And
So Christina, your interest in camels was inspired by a search for dietary or nutritional help for your son, correct?
Yes, it was. I had no background in camels or autism or anything like that before. I had been a career writer, and then I got a master's degree in an MFA in creative writing fiction and had written a novel, and chances were pretty decent I would have gotten it published, but then he was diagnosed when he was almost three, so that's when I went to the world of biomedical and behavioral and all those things you learn when you're dealing with such a multifaceted issue as autism. And with my background in working at the Pentagon in aerospace, I'd been able to dig deeply into, you know, dense documents and things like that. So I was able to really ramp up on the research. And so I learned that you have to do a lot of things to help a child get better from some of their autism symptoms, which are disabling. And so that was what my first book was about. I dropped my novel and I wrote A Real Boy, A True Story of Autism, Early Intervention and Recovery. And so that book came out and I was doing some speaking and all that, but I was about to become a single mom. And then I happened to show up at a book fair and I saw a creature that changed my life.
Well, why don't you read us from the book, from Camel Crazy, that experience, what changed your life?
Yes, I'd be happy to. So, how about Chapter 1 from Camel Crazy, A Quest for Miracles in the Mysterious World of Camels? So this is titled Meeting the Camel, and the subtitle is What Else Do They Do with the Milk? Me to a Camel Man. The camel stands calmly, munching something hay-like, placid in her dirty blonde summer coat. Her great head grows like a question mark from the curve of her muscular neck. Padded, leathery feet keep her comfortable on the bare spots of the lawn. She ignores the children offering pink tufts of cotton candy, staring at her with freckles wringing the O's of their open mouths. She was trundled in a horse van to this college in Orange County, California, 2 hours in a rocky mountain from her home in fire-scorched farm country. Her eyes watched the humans scattered on the green grass at this Sunday afternoon book festival. Her long lashes hide the clear inner eyelid that will automatically close if an unlikely coastal sandstorm roars in. This camel knows her mission. She tolerates the admiring glances and rude remarks like, "What's a camel doing here?" She knows that her human owner, the alpha bull of her herd, is nearby if she needs him. Little can faze her, as she has no natural predators and a nuanced startle reflex, although fluttering fabric and sudden movements may annoy her. Her eyes express a confident view of her place in the world, composed at this moment of a task, the pen that holds her, and something to nibble with a little water on the side. Today, her job is to be a camel at a fair. What she doesn't know is that her blood can work medical miracles. Her flesh is kin to that of million-dollar racing camels. Her organs are debated, and her milk has healed the sick for centuries. She also doesn't know that she's about to launch a movement that will drive her species price sky high, that people will clamor for the milk she gives, which will help fuel a modern resurgence of her kind. Neither do I. At this moment, she's just a camel, and I'm just a fearful, newly separated single mother. She will inspire me to seek the surprising remedy for my son's autism symptoms and to become a camel milk expert. This creature will throw me into research, dispatch me across the United States, India, and the United Arab Emirates, and send my words to places like Malaysia, Sweden, England, Cyprus, Mongolia, France, and Pakistan. She'll cause scoffing and admiration, inspire scientific research and many products. But now I stand by her broadside, as bored as she is, watching her. She's tall and stolid, seemingly unflappable. Camels are like that, able to keep going without complaint for miles and kilometers, hauling salt, fat-bellied tourists, large milk cans, towing wagons, trucks, and carts draped in glittering scarlet curtains, carrying entire households on their backs. But I don't know this. I just wonder why a camel's here if none of these kids are riding it. I see the long eyelashes blink once. I spot a flapping tent behind her and walk over to investigate. There are small white bottles of camel milk lotion and soaps. I like soap. I lift a smooth, wavy bar to smell it, and the scent of lavender moves lightly across my upper lip. A man in a green baseball cap shifts behind the counter. "Hi," I say, "is that your camel?" "Yes, sure is. We make soap and lotion from camel milk. Very natural and healthy stuff." I try a dab of the white lotion. It's thin and spreads easily as light as sunshine. Then I ask, "What else did they do with the milk?" I don't know why I'm asking. Perhaps boredom is driving me to prolong the chat, or maybe that's just how I am, always curious. Probably both. They give it to premature infants in hospitals in the Middle East. It's supposed to not cause any allergies. "Really? It's non-allergenic milk?" "It's said to be close to mother's milk, like breast milk." "Thanks." I look at my son Jonah, sitting on a nearby slope, knees nestled in the grass as he reads an airplane book. His 4 years of autism therapies have cost $500,000. Right now, he's a happy, blue-eyed, seven-year-old charmer, fitting few people's idea of autism. But a trace amount of milk can send him into a trance, staring at a wall or laughing at nothing. He can disappear inside his head or up a ladder, atop a wall, or anywhere. Or one day, I worry, out of his classroom and into special ed. I bring my son to the camel, stand him before the rounded belly and single hump. I tell him, "It's a camel." And he says, "Okay, Mom, I have to find this milk."
And that was Christina Adams reading from Camel Crazy, A Quest for Miracles in the Mysterious World of Camels. Now, that seems like kind of not a lot to get you started on this quest. It was kind of just a gentle nudge. But you took it really seriously, didn't you?
Well, I did, because there was a lot behind it. As they always say, what is success is luck meets opportunity, or preparation meets luck, or something like that.
Yeah.
I'm mangling that, but you know, I think we all know what I'm grappling toward. So basically, I had behind me several years of biomedical research into my son's condition. And it turned out that it's quite complex. So autism is tied to the immune system, and it, not in all cases, but in many, quite a few, actually, I would say the most, but that wasn't really known at the time except for in this world of autism. And so doctors were just beginning to explore that, and just a few doctors at that. And so I dug into it, and moms were always the leaders into this stuff, and I became one of them. And so I knew that milk from other animals had always caused him problems. Milk from a cow would make him hand flap, toe walk, and then he, when he was able to speak well enough, he said, "It feels like there's dirt in my brain." So I wasn't the first to know that milk helped exacerbate and create autism symptoms, but it was very manifest in my son. So when I took that away, he got a lot better. But the other milk, some things that were alternatives, would also fire his allergic responses, like all the vegan-type milks, rice, nut, stuff like that. So I really did really want an animal milk because I knew that it would help build bone health, and we know now studies bear that out better than vegan milks. And so I was always on the look, and we were just stuck with potato milk at the time, which was powder that I mixed up, and it was okay, but nonetheless, still looking for that elusive milk substitute. So when I, heard that it might be close to breast milk and that it was non-allergenic, that was my idea. It just came right there. But it was all that research that I was carrying around inside me and experience. And that, I could say it's intuition. That was a very powerful intuition. But intuition is nothing more than like advanced pattern recognition or, a bed of knowledge that we have in us. So that's what it was. Like every American kid, you grew up eating, ice cream, milk, and formula that had milk based in it. And it always bothered him. His cheeks were very red and things like that. I'd say to the regular pediatrician at that time, "Shouldn't we change this?" "Oh, no, it's fine, whatever." So there was nobody that was going to do anything about it until he was diagnosed with autism. And then the other mom said, "This, this, and this. Do not mess around and waste time like we did. See this doctor or hire this attorney to help get the school to give you therapy. Start immediately." And so that's the story I told in A Real Boy, my first book. But then, so Real Boy had just been out for a few months when I stared at this creature and was inspired to go on the camel journey.
Now, it doesn't seem like it should be that hard to find camel's milk, but I'm wrong.
It's easy now, not hard at all now, but back then, that fateful day, I went home and I researched in the internet, and there were about four articles, and they were medical journal articles, and they just said weird things like it's used for wound healing in Russia in 1972, or it's hard to make cheese out of camel milk because it doesn't coagulate like other milk. So there was zero about autism or things like that. But I just knew I had this passion of, like, it just wasn't even a passion. I would just say it's just like something I had to do, period, something I have to do. And so then I did become a single mom and moved into a condo behind a freeway. And but I didn't give up on trying to find the milk. And so I went back to a library, a university library, and a few months later, and I saw that there had just been an article published. And in Israel, a couple of doctors had published an article that they had given camel milk to children with autism and they got better. And so it was a short-term article, but I thought that just confirms I'm on the right track. So then I had to start talking to all my friends and getting desperate, and people looked at me like a little bit like I was crazy, but most people were like, "No, that sounds reasonable." So I had a Pakistani friend I had met recently, and he said, "I'm going to Israel and I think they sell it there, and I'll try to bring some back." And then I'm sitting outdoors one day around Christmas, and I get the phone call, and he says, "Well, I'm back, and the good news is I got some." Yay.
Oh, wow.
The bad news is it was dumped at the docks at JFK. But he had a phone number for me, and I called to Israel, and I called a couple people, and one person I woke up in the night sent me to another person. He did have Bedouin camel milk, which I would eventually end up getting, but his English was very limited. And he sent me to somebody else, and that was a research, he's a cancer researcher, a biomedical expert, and a doctor, so a PhD. So I was lucky. We started Skyping, and he in Israel, me in America, and we formed our joint ideas about autism and camel milk, and because he knew camel milk and I knew autism, and together we had an idea, and I got some in from Israel, some frozen raw Bedouin milk in liter bottles. And it was like a miracle when I was standing in my condo by the freeway in California holding these rock solid frozen bottles of raw Bedouin milk in my hands. It was just an incredible moment.
And then you were like collecting it for a while, it seemed like. You didn't want to.
Yeah,
you wanted to go about it scientifically, so you weren't willing to give it to your son to experiment with it until you could actually set up a valid experiment.
Yeah, and so my son had already had a ton of data on him, both medically and behaviorally, and so he was. I had a whole stack on him, and so I wanted to give it to him in the best way I could, like sort of a blinded trial, where I would have observers observe him without knowing that he was on milk and take data. But at that time, he didn't have any behavioral services, so I was trying to get some, and that, you know, as anything bureaucracy goes with these kind of situations, it takes months, if ever. And then he started not doing well again. Biochemical matters in autism exist, and they definitely affect how they function. And so this is not unusual, but he started to regress, and his behavior got really wild and hard to handle. And he was, you know, 7, 8 years old, and it was really tough. I mean, it already had been tough, but he was in a good place. And then he started getting really hard to handle, and food would not help. Just a little bit of protein would help, but nothing could mitigate those kind of wild symptoms. So I was getting desperate. And that's when I gave him the 4 ounces of milk at bedtime. And in the morning, woke up to such a changed child. It's just amazing to this day.
That's a miracle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, the word miracle is a great word because there are science reasons for all of this. But when you see such an incredible shift that you don't expect, then it does feel like a, you know, really a miracle.
Yeah. I'm sure it did.
And were the results lasting?
Well, of course, the results, you know, were greater speech and better motor skills and more emotional content and more executive functioning, as they call it, the ability to plan and carry out a task and attention, able to cross the street without me hanging on to him, all kinds of amazing things. And then his skin started getting better. So from the inside out, it was having an immune modulating effect on him and making him healthier. So it did continue. But then he always still had the food problem, even though that was greatly mitigated. So any food infraction he would have after that, I'd just give him some camel milk, and within 15 minutes, he's back to normal. No climbing up the walls and, you know, getting oppositional and bossy and all that stuff that happens. So it did continue for a long time. And then the great part was that I had the idea then, hey, I heard that camels are getting milked in America. Wow, I saw it on Facebook. So I thought, if these Amish guys are milking camels in America, who better to try it than this guy right here? And so I did get a hold of some Amish camel milk, and I gave it to my son, and it worked the same way. So he was patient zero in that aspect, like the first kid that had used camel milk from 2 different countries, which had the same effect for autism. And so that showed to me, scientifically, it wasn't just like the breed or the feed or whatever it was that everybody at that time didn't know if it was just that country's camels. And it showed, no, the camel itself is the delivery platform.
Mm. And where did you find Amish camels?
Well, the Amish people, there was one guy, and I write about some amazing characters in Camel Crazy, so I really want you guys to join me on this trip because it's been amazing. So this one Amish man, he had gone to become a Mennonite because he wanted to actually, you know, he had his own personal reasons for doing it, but some of them included, you know, he wanted to go on the internet, he wanted to expand things, he wanted to do things like that. He was a businessman, but he wanted to kind of grow, and then he had some faith type of reasons, but so he became a Mennonite, but he still lived very much similar to an Amish manner. So, but he was on Facebook. So he posed, there was a little group called Healing with Camel Milk, and I joined it. It was only 40 people in it, or maybe less then. And he started saying, like, really rude things. And I'm like, who is this person? Wait, how can an Amish person be on the Internet? Wait a minute. But so he was really rude, and I was like, what's going on here? But then it turns out they thought I was a spy for somebody else, you know. And there's Camel Crazy. It's called that for a reason. So but then, you know, no, I'm not a spy for someone else. I'm just me. And so then it all worked out, and I got the milk that way. So I got the milk from some of our wonderful Amish farmers who are still producing in greater number than ever before. And but then I become friends with this guy. His name is Marlon Troyer. He's in my book. He's got a heart of gold, and I always told him after I met him, I'm like, you are the Ted Nugent of the camel world. And he's like, who's Ted Nugent? So,
he's
great.
So was that in California that you found these?
No. Yeah, no, I had to get the camel milk from we don't have that many Amish people in California that I know of. I know there are some Mennonite people and all that, but most of the Amish communities tend to be in the states where there's kind of more affordable rural land.
Yeah,
so I got it from the Midwest kind of areas. But there also is a great camel farm in California. It's called Oasis Camel Dairy. And so after this, you know, when I started trying to find this milk, I reached out to camel people, and first I couldn't find them because camel people on the internet were not really, you know, no one wrote me back. I couldn't find anyone. Now that I'm in the camel community, you know, I understand they like to mind their business and not sure who's coming around asking them things about their animals and such. But I did find a great farm in California. It's called Oasis Camel Dairy, and they've turned out to be amazing people. So I featured them in the book. He's a camel whisperer. His name is Gil Riegler, and his wife is an exotic bird trainer, and they have this amazing farm, Oasis Camel Dairy, that the public can visit. But they never heard of camel milk and autism because, of course, nobody had. It was really my idea, other than that, you know, Israeli scientist people over there. But then it turns out that he had a relative. He was from Israel and had a relative living near my camel milk producer in Israel. So he said, I will help you bring some back next time I go there. So I got USDA federal permission to keep shipping in camel milk for my son. And the beautiful thing is those raw liter bottles of camel milk, you know, 48 bottles, two suitcases, all across the world when customs and clearing through and all that, everyone just said, oh, it's for a mother and a child who needs it. You know, bless you. Everybody was so kind, and I never lost a shipment of milk in a customs again.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And you went to Amish country in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania as well, which I grew up in Strasburg, which is very near Bird in Hand.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Beautiful Bird in Hand. I have had the wonderful experience in this book. So, you know, first I'm just, you know, living in California, being a mom struggling to survive. And so then I branched out to the camel people, and then I went to the farms in Amish country, and one of our excellent farms is Miller's Organic Farms. And so that was the first time I'd ever seen a camel being milked, and also in America, to see camels on a farm surrounded by cattle and all that. You know, there in Pennsylvania, you'll be familiar with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is a strange sight. You see cows, you see horses.
Yeah.
You're not going to see camels. So I shared that experience with people on what it's like. And I didn't really know how to interact with the Amish people then. You know, I didn't know many Muslim people. I didn't know any Hindu people. I didn't know any Amish people. And so that's the most beautiful thing about it for me personally, is making friends with people from so many cultures. And the book certainly tries to share that journey. But, the Amish guys were great and super welcoming, and so I write about some of their stories and how they live, and then I interviewed the Somali people. I spent time with them in San Diego, and they're the most camel-crazy country in the world. And so these wonderful Somali people who grew up with camels, about camels, owning camels, paying bride prices in camels for their wives, and a woman camel herder who was a very proud, amazing human being. I spent time with them, and I share their lore and stories in the book, and they're some of my favorites because they have such dignity living here as immigrants, but they've lost so much, and I'm just moved every time I read about them in my own book. Maybe that's silly as a writer, but you know, I care very much about their story, and I'm very moved by them.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Christina Adams, author of Camel Crazy, A Quest for Miracles in the Mysterious World of Camels. Now, Christina, because you were a journalist, because you'd written a book and published a best-selling book before, did you decide pretty early on in this quest that this was going to be a book?
Not really. That's a good question, because at that time, you know, just newly single with the child with all the responsibility, and I didn't have any family around to help. I didn't know what I was going to do. I mean, part of me wanted to move to New York and build on my previous success, but I knew that was not going to happen. And second of all, I just thought, do I need to get a job? I did try to work, get freelance writing work, but the demands of my son's needs made that impossible as well. So I really didn't know what I was going to do. I did keep a hand in writing and all that, and I did a lot of advocacy work for autism and advised parents. But I did take a picture the first night I gave it to him. So I have pictures of him taking it for the first time because I just thought it's important.
Yeah, you have that
so,
in the book. You have a picture.
Yeah, so I have it in the book, and I save it for all those years. And so I did write the articles, and they did go viral and help start the industry that we see now, the global industry in camel milk. But I guess the book idea came a little bit later, but I have been interviewing people for a long, long time.
You know, that picture that you have of him, the first time he had it, the expression on his face is so sweet. I mean, you know, I can understand why you kept that, because you thought he's like saying, yeah, this feels good, you know?
Oh, I'll tell you, these guys get a hook in you. Once you have a kid, it's all done with. You give it up. I look at pictures of him now even, and I'm like, oh, he was so cute, blonde hair, blue eyes, little sweet face, and no wonder I just him helpless to not do anything for him. I have to.
How old is he now?
That guy has just turned 22, and he's delightful. In the book, I actually interviewed him for the book. He's very supportive of it, and he's always funny and has hilarious observations. He's very high IQ person. His language is amazing. And that's the thing. After the camel milk, too, he was tested, and his language is that of a college level, even though he was 9 years old. And
oh my God.
So, yeah, he's really into, he knows more European history than I've ever known in my life, and really into politics, humor, very funny guy. So he's in community college and has worked, but now he's focusing on his studies a little bit more, and has his friend circle, and he's into music, and he's very good at drawing. He's got a gift for pencil and ink and drawing portraits. He's very good at that.
So this journey started 15 years ago for you.
Yeah.
And the book just came out, right?
Mm-hmm. It's brand new.
So when did you start writing it? And tell us a little bit about the process of creating the book.
Yeah, the writing of this book was really interesting because it had some unique challenges. So it's my second memoir, but this one has got a lot of narrative nonfiction in it because I interviewed and, basically did reporting for it too in India and the Middle East and here in America and some other countries, even though I managed to conduct interviews in. So it was challenging because there's science in it. Some of the science, of course, I bring to the table myself and my observations, but then some of it in studies that I've combed through. So it's got a lot of science, and that you've got to really understand and dig deeply and cross-reference and make sure you're saying what's correct. It's got very current science. So the footnotes are all in the back. I don't bore you to death with science, but I make it pretty readable, I hope. And chapter 15 pretty much has a good science summation in it, even though all my work is accessible to people. That's one of my goals. So it also had a lot of challenges with cultural issues. So I'm engaging with people not of my background. Sometimes I don't ever know back then when to shake hands with someone, a man from a Muslim faith. Sometimes they will shake your hand. Sometimes they don't. It's all different. And so in the book, sometimes I'm like, well, I'm meeting this person. I'm in Dubai. I don't know if I should extend my hand or not. And then, you know, I wait for them to do it. And then I was feeling confident in Somali in San Diego, like it's a little Somalia sort of. I was feeling confident because I'd had this great day with a bunch of elders, and someone shook my hand. And then I thought, okay, this looks like the senior elder wants to shake my hand. So I put my hand out, and he puts his hand out too, but he crooks his arm, and he laces it through mine, and makes this courtly little bow, so we never touch. It's like we're square dancing.
Oh.
Super cute. And so like the cultural issues. So then I'm interviewing, you know, I went to India, so I'm with the herders, as you'll just read in the book, Camel Crazy here. And so it was getting translation, and I don't have a budget, you know, for that. I just find people that do it for me. And translating, and then cultural. It's always like, you know, am I saying something that is going to offend them, or do they understand what I'm saying? Or, but it's all worked out well. And then when you're writing about people's mythology, which, you know, or their faith, you know, there are myths, there are faiths. Everybody's got their different view on which is which. But if you're writing about their religion, then, you know, you want to make sure you get it right. So I did use a sensitivity reader. I used more than one. I had one main sensitivity reader who's an excellent person herself, a writer. And then I used whatever culture I was writing about. I did run things past members of that culture, so I can make sure that I wasn't inadvertently, you know, saying something that wasn't correct or offensive.
Well, that's very important. Very important.
Yes. And then there's the translation. So, you know, I had to get some Somali read for me. I had to get some Arabic read for me. I had to get some Hindi and Marwadi read for me. And then the digging in the camel facts. So luckily I'm supported by a lot of people in the science community. Wonderful veterinarians have been key to my work. I profile a few of them in the book, like especially the women. But the veterinarians have been really great. So sometimes I've said, hey, what about this camel startle reflex? There's zero research on it out there. And then they'll say, like, that's a really good question, because guess what? Nobody really knows. This is our opinion from country to country, which varies. But yeah, there is no research on it. So you're adding something valuable just by asking this question. So it is a very complex book, I'll put it that way. And then, of course, there's the part where, you know, the people are, I get a little bit flirted with, and then there's some stuff that happens in the camel souk that's kind of interesting in Abu Dhabi. So it's a woman adventure, but it's also an anyone adventure, because there are a lot of people in here, are a lot of men in this book, and then a lot of amazing women, too.
Wow. Now, when you first started looking for camel milk, it seemed like no one was selling it in the U.S., but there were people who had camels, and even when you approached them, they just thought the idea of selling camel milk wasn't something they really wanted to do. Why is that?
Right. Well, I've kind of learned since then that there are animal people that like animals, and they can make a living off of them, exotic animals or what other kinds. But then the dairy thing is like a different mentality almost. So it took the Amish people coming along, and they're very utilitarian, practical people. And so the Amish people weren't milking camels when I first had my idea, but they just started in like 2011. And so they were the ones that look at it as a farm animal. Like, this is an animal, we can make money off of it, we can learn to handle it, and they did it. They are really the most ingenious people you've ever met. So that's the ones who have driven it forward. Now we have other farmers who are not Amish, and they're doing well. There's a farm in Colorado who he's not only milking camels, but he's also milking donkey and buffalo now.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, there were some, in some states, issues about selling unpasteurized milk. It may be illegal. Does pasteurized camel milk have the same impact for autism?
Well, for many people, it works fine. In Camel Crazy, you read the story and all that, but then I know what people want. So in the back, I have an appendix. It's got a user's guide to camel milk. So it answers all those questions, and then it says how much should you take for different health conditions like diabetes, Crohn's disease, juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, between rounds of chemo, food allergies, diabetes type 1 and 2, actually I didn't say 1 and 2, autism, things like that, chronic inflammation. That's what it's used for around the world now. And the pasteurized, many people do fine on pasteurized. Some people, they need the raw. And basically, 43 states in the United States now provide for some form of raw milk. So the trend is toward raw milk rather than away. And so some states, you know, you have to drive to the farm and get it. Other states, it's like, sure, you sell it wherever you want. So it's not illegal in the United States. Shipping, you know, raw milk across state lines for human consumption at a federal level, that's where you get into the legal stuff. But state to state, the laws all, some don't allow any, and other, but like I said, 43 allow some.
Wow.
You know, Monica, when we lived in the little house on the farm, we drank raw milk.
I know. Well, yeah. Even after we moved into Strasburg.
Yeah. What species? A cow?
Cow, yeah. We just went, you know, this was in Lancaster County, and we would go to the farm and get milk. Now,
yeah, it was a herd of Guernsey cows. And
The farmer did sell milk to dairies also. You know, they had the whole, you know, dairy operation, but we would buy it pre-dairy.
Yeah, so I'm not a fanatic one way or another. I mean, what I always try to do is be the reasonable person. And so raw milk with a herd that is very well taken care of and has been tested for certain things like brucellosis and all these other kind of issues, and that the milk is handled cleanly, that's a great substance. The problem with, you know, in my opinion, I guess, is it's all about the handling. If the herd is healthy, then it's the handling.
Right.
I do say in the book that I've been around cows. I've slid in many a cow pie. And so camels have these little tiny grassy poops that just look like big hamster droppings, and they're pretty dry. And so you don't have the messy feces issue that you do have with cows. That's one of the great things about them. They're also naturally pretty disease resistant. They can get a couple diseases, a few of them, but naturally they tend not to. So we have had a lot of raw milk being drunk in America now for years from camels, and there has not been an issue yet.
Oh, that's good to know.
Yeah. Plus, yeah. I do say to people, you should ask your farmer, you know, about their vet care. Some of our farmers do testing where they do what's called a coliform count. They actually have the milk tested to see if it has anything in it that it's not supposed to, like called pathogens. And one of our farmers, Marlon, I was talking about, he has zero coliform count, takes very good care of his milk. And more, actually, the regulations permit you to have some, but he has zero. So,
is anybody canning camel's milk?
Can. Well, that's a good one. I've seen paper cylinders. I've seen packet little sachets. Camelicious, the brand from the Middle East that I take you to their amazing farm with 3,500 camels in Camel Crazy. They are selling packets of it. I think the website is Camelicious One in America. You can get these little, they're called sachets in other countries. They're just little folders, you know, little envelopes of milk that make a serving. So you can buy that. It's got to be somewhere. I mean, I've even seen camel hump fat. I've seen camel hump fat in jars for sale in the Middle East.
Wow.
You name it, there's somebody somewhere that's going to have something.
And I think I saw you can get it powdered.
Yeah. Like I was talking about the Camelicious One site, they have the powder. And there is freeze-dried powder that tends to, you know, most of these pasteurization methods we use in the camel world, the people want the very flash pasteurized milk. That means very quickly heated and then cooled immediately. So that tends to retain more of the properties that the raw milk does. And so the old method was the vat pasteurizing, and we don't like UHT because that just cooks everything for that long, ultra heat treated. We don't want that camel stuff, camel milk. We don't. So we try to keep it. The farmers try to keep the camels being treated like organically. Their feed is very carefully monitored. The health is monitored because the families and the health market that drives this, they want the cleanest, purest animal and milk that you can get.
Well, Christina, once you had developed a source for your son's camel milk, you still went far beyond that in terms of researching camels.
Yes, I did. That's also why it's called Camel Crazy. I can't say why I did that. I have the blessing or the curse of writing books about books that don't exist but need to exist. So I suppose that's part of what, I don't know, I guess I just really felt like this helps people and no one knows anything about it. And so I have to get it out there. So that's what I try to do, write things that I look for and don't exist, then I write them. So I just did. And also the people break my heart. I love the camel people. They're amazing, they're welcoming, and they have this gift. They're attached to camels. Now, in America, we don't have that long camel culture, but we do have nomadic people here who now have come here, people from Niger, and they train camels. And so we do have some camel people here. But in the other countries, they've done this for centuries. Like the Raika people in India, who I write about in my book, they believe that Lord Shiva created them as camel caregivers, and it's a sacred duty. And it was always taboo to sell camel milk in most countries. It was given away to the sick for free. So only recently have they come to the point where some are going to sell camel milk. And that's one of the reasons I went to India, to try to help them, make them aware of the value of their milk to this market, and give them some way that they can survive, because camel use is dropping in India. People use trucks now instead of draft animals like
right.
camels.
Right.
And then they've got some laws put on them that they can't sell them out of the state of Rajasthan. So the camel culture is just dropping like a stone in India, and we're hoping that the milk will help turn it around. So I write about that adventure in Camel Crazy. But yeah, I love the camel cultures. I want to help them, and I like to tell the story. I mean, you can't ask for a better story opportunity than sitting in a beautiful place surrounded by camels bellowing and grunting, and people drinking their, you know, heritage narcotic tea around you, and their beautiful
Wait,
clothing
their,
that
their,
they wear.
Their heritage narcotic tea?
You heard that correctly.
Yeah. I noticed you mentioned that a couple of times in your book, and just what is in that?
Well, I don't know exactly what that herb was. I should have asked more questions, but so it's a relaxing beverage that the Raika people have in the morning after they do their milking of their camels out in that pretty forest land that they have, grazing land. They do their duty, and they sit around in their blankets, and they have the relaxing tea. So,
uh-huh.
Like I said, you can't ask for a more scenic bit of reporting opportunity than you get with that.
Now, milk cows have to be milked twice a day. Do camels, if you're in a camel dairy, do they have to do it twice a day?
They do it twice a day. I'm sure some people, you know, have slightly altered schedules, but yeah the dairies generally do morning and afternoon.
Yeah.
So you get more in the morning, but the afternoon you get some too. It's also something I like is a very ethical form of dairy. These camels are taken care of. You cannot get milk from a female camel if it's not happy. If it doesn't like you and it's not happy, you're not going to get that milk. So,
oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it will not give it. So that's why you have to bond with it and make it happy. I mean, the camel, female camel's a role model for us women, don't you think? Like, if we're not happy, you're not going to get what you want. So
what's, like, what is the breeding cycle of camels? Like, when can you milk them, and what happens with the babies?
Yeah, so their pregnancy is pretty long. It's about 13 months. And that's another reason why the milk is expensive, because they don't give as much as other, you know, as a cow. And then the pregnancy is long and they only have one. And then they nurse for about a year. They can go longer, but then that's when you get them pregnant all over again. And the babies are generally kept with the milk to stimulate the nursing. Now, I have gone to the two large Middle Eastern dairies, which I do describe those beautiful adventures in Camel Crazy, and the camels there have been trained to just float across the sand happily to go in with their milking without anyone, you know, helping them or anything. It's just beautiful. But it's incredible to watch, you know, dozens and dozens of camels streaming across this gleaming sand to go be milked happily in the desert. But here in America, they usually let the babies come around, you know, get some and snuffle around and all that, and then they let the that starts the milk flow, and then they do it for the bottles. But it's enough for the camels are getting plenty. It's not an issue. Also, then they, you know, the issue of the babies, you have to breed your camels, of course, to get a baby. And the bull camels, one bull camel, like in the Middle East, he gets in a house of 24 girl camels. And so he can have a harem and make, you know, all those animals pregnant. But bull camels are pretty fierce, really dangerous animals when they're what's called in rut. So I do write about the entertaining and dangerous parts of camel owning in Camel Crazy, and their amazing reproductive cycle, because the females won't even let down their eggs until the bull has had his way with them, and then that stimulates the egg to let down. So it's super efficient. It's like a vending machine egg. Yeah, incredible.
Wow.
That's another reason why people who don't know and study and understand about camels shouldn't just have one, you know, I mean, because they're complex. They're complex animals.
Yeah, they are complex. You can handle them and they're fine, but you have to know what you're doing. That's why I do write about it, because people always want to buy camels, and when they, you know, oh, I want to get some. But I say, well, you can get some, but you've got to get expert advice. Otherwise, you're going to end up squashed under a camel that's annoyed at you, and you will not get up.
Wow. Yeah, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's why they survive so long, I expect.
They are very, very honed for survival. And then, like, in the end of the book, Camel Crazy, I do talk about their importance. I mean, camels are really important, especially with the climate getting hotter and drier. They are so much better of an animal to help the earth and to give this incredible milk than cows are. Nothing against cows. And sometimes in their well-run environments with the pastoralists that take care of them or the regenerative agriculture that take care of them properly, you know, not in these big feedlots, then it's fine. But camels would be a great animal for people to start using more of. So I do talk about that. And then they're also being used for medical uses now, like a snake bite treatment, for immunotherapy, camel lids, you know, which includes guanacos, vicuñas, llamas, alpacas, and camels. They are like medically pretty amazing. So they have these tiny nanobodies, you know, that go into the milk and in their bodies, and then you can use those as a medical platform, which is being done. So you just never know that camels are so incredible as they are.
And what's this about camel's urine?
Oh, yes. So other cultures, you know, they have knowledge of these heritage uses of things that we do not. I mean, you use what's at hand when you don't have pharma drugs and all that stuff. So there is a medical basis for urine in medicine. So like the drug Premarin is made for women out of pregnant mare's urine, and that's a pharma drug. But the camel urine is thought to be a curative for many things. And I don't say the word cure, but curative, as in it can have the beneficial effect. And there is some emerging research on urine. There are some reports, anecdotal reports, which I have not met the people myself, but there are people using it in the Middle East, Kuwait, for patients with cancer and other difficult issues. And some of them are either A, improving and they don't have cancer anymore, or B, it's prolonging their life if it's a really late stage tough cancer. That's the reports. I don't say anything about it one way or the other as far as my own observation, but that's what I've seen reports and heard of. And they're mixing it into a cocktail, milk and urine, and I'm told it tastes like kombucha. But that's all I need to be told at this point about it, because it's other than drinking it, because I don't intend to drink it. But if I got very, very sick, yes, I suppose
you,
I would.
You would give it a try.
If I was that sick, I would. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How many, I mean, do all children with autism who try camel's milk show improvement?
No, all of them don't. A lot of them do, and at different levels of improvement. But autism, you know, we know now that it's like there's different subsets of autism, subtypes, and some of them are much more affected by their immune dysfunction than the others. And you'd never know till you try, though. That's the thing. Like, I would have sworn that my son was controlled for inflammation and all that stuff, but it turns out he was not controlled, and so he benefited immensely. And you just never know till you try. And B, also, children need bone-building things to eat and drink. So the calcium and the animal milk content is so great, as opposed to some of the other alternatives like vegan milk or just vegetables or things. And those are all great too, but giving that animal milk is very, very good for them. So it's still a great nutritional product, even if it doesn't show like a kind of, you know, astonishing effect therapeutically.
Now, there is no cure known for autism, correctly? Is that correct?
That's correct. There's not. I do know a lot of people who have the kind of kids, they have poured a lot of resources into the kids, who the kids really don't show many signs of autism anymore. You know, they might be a little bit unique in one way or another. They might have their own, you know, tiny issues, but a lot of them don't show signs of autism anymore and wouldn't qualify. So I don't say cure. I don't think we should say cure for that, but it's functionally they were, you know, put in remission or cure state or whatever you want to call that. So, I mean, there are plenty of cases like that. There certainly are. I know the kids. I've seen them. I've also seen kids that you would not know that they ever were the level of severity that they were. You would never know that. Like kids that I've seen that I thought, oh, that child is cognitively so impaired. They're never going to speak. They're never going to. Now they're in college and they're getting scholarships. It's just unbelievable.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. And then there's, you know, a few that just really don't make tons of progress outwardly. But you cannot assume that they're not intelligent. Like autism, people with autism generally are very intelligent, even more than the general population. And some do have cognitive impairment, but you have to assume competence. So just because someone doesn't speak doesn't mean they have nothing to say.
That's right. We don't think about that, but that's absolutely true.
Right. Mm-hmm.
How is autism, like, where is the dividing line between saying somebody's autistic and just someone's a little peculiar?
Well, that's the tough part because so far it's an observational diagnosis.
Mm.
So you might think, oh boy, he's doing this weird things that looks like autism, lining up cars or, you know, fixating on something, he's not talking. And take them to a general pediatrician, they'll say, oh, give them time, or oh, it's no big deal, or whatever. But then you take them to an autism specialist, and they would say, yeah, they definitely look like they're on the spectrum, so start early intervention, do this and that. Or you can take them then to a integrative medicine doctor, and they'll say, okay, let's run some tests. So let's look at, you know, their stool tests, their blood work, their allergic response, their this and that. We'll do some genetic tests, and they will say, yes, biomedically, they are showing that they have these issues, and let's get started on those things, supplements, diet, all that, to try to control their physical health so their function will be better. So there's no blood test for autism per se yet. It's all observational. So you can ask 10 doctors, is this kid autistic? You might get 8 of them saying, no, let's watch and wait. But 2 of them are going to know what they're going to look at, and then they're going to say, yeah, let's get started now.
Mm. Do you feel that maybe sometimes there's overdiagnosis?
No, I don't. I've studied this for a long time. So first of all, it's a hard diagnosis to get because the mainstream people that we encounter as parents don't really, A, know what they're looking at, B, don't want to diagnose. Because nobody wants to tell their child, their patient, oh, your son has autism. They don't want to do it. So, and they want to watch and wait. So then, you know, you get referred to a specialist if you keep pushing, or you get kicked out of the preschool because preschools know what they're looking at. Oh my goodness, they're the ones. I mean, you take your kid to a preschool, if he gets kicked out in a week, he's got autism probably. You know, I've lived it. So, they know what they're looking at, but you know, they can't tell you either. So you have to run around and try to get that diagnosis. And there are still, like, people of color, their children are diagnosed much later, and they don't really get nearly as much intervention. So that's hard. Overdiagnosis, where you might get this situation is, that they're talking about is, used to there were people with mental retardation or other things. They might have been given an autism diagnosis now that they would have been called mentally retarded before. You know, when they use that now, people say, you know, more intellectually disabled or cognitive disability. But so that could account for some of the new cases it does. Or if a state does a survey, then they're like, oh, people moved into our state with autism because we have better services, so we got more. But so there's a few like that you did catch that you didn't before. Also, what they used to call Asperger's, they've gotten rid of that now. But
I didn't know
that.
Yeah,
that's no longer. Yeah, they changed the DSM, and partly was to get rid of the rising numbers of autism diagnosed. They thought, we'll just take out the Asperger thing, and then we'll just throw everything into autism spectrum disorder. So that diagnosis officially doesn't exist. So a lot of those kids are getting overlooked because nobody wants to give them an autism diagnosis, or they're just said, oh, they're on the spectrum. But then it sort of minimizes it a little bit. They don't get the whole biomedical and the whole, service thing that they can. So I really don't think it's overdiagnosis. And here's the other thing, like the official CDC count has been like one out of every 59 U.S. children. Now you got to remember, when I started this, it was one out of 10,000.
Whoa.
And then it was one out of 2,500. Then it was one out of, you know, it's just crazy. We've watched it dropping and dropping, we parents. And we were just like, yeah, well, we said so. And so they had that number. But then if you dig into the data, which I did, and they asked the parents, they did a survey, NIH did a survey where they asked the parents, has your child ever been diagnosed with an autism spectrum disorder, or told, you know, like that someone told you that they had it, like a doctor? And so the parents said, they said yes, and that's one out of every 36.
Oh, my.
See, so, but that's still not the, quote, official. It's the sub-official.
Right.
So,
right.
And that's very high. Like some states, one out of 25, one out of, you know, one out of 32. And the costs are going to go up because, you know, 15 years ago, the lifetime cost of someone with autism was $3 million to support them. And so now with this, the crippling costs are coming up ahead. But so I fear that the only response is going to be cut back the diagnosis, cut back, deny, so that we don't have to pay for them.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not good.
So, Christine, I want to go back to just a little, something from the first chapter that you read, which is when you first saw a camel at a book festival. Why did they bring a camel to a book festival?
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. To this day, I probably should have asked. I should probably ask that guy, because that guy ended up being my friend.
Right.
And his camel is on the front of my book. That's Cleopatra, you see, on the front of this book. Yeah, beautiful camel. But that's not the first one that I met. So I guess they thought children, you know, might like to see an animal, and he was selling soap and lotion. I'll have to go back and say what brought you to that. But they do, like many camel people do, bring their animals around to fairs and nativity events. And generally, the camels are extremely well cared for. I just want the public to know that. I mean, you might see one every now and then that you don't like what's going on, you don't see what's going on, but generally, they're very, very, very well taken care of. They're expensive animals, and they're very taken care of. And so I believe it's good to take animals to the public where they can see them, because we're losing touch with any sense of what dirt feels like, what a farm is like, what a real animal is like. And so I believe that you have to show animals in a good, positive way, as long as it's safe and they're taken care of properly. Then having animals interact with the public is good, because you can't protect an animal that you don't know exists.
Mm, good point. Good point.
Yeah.
So of all the places that you went to research for this book, is there any place you'd really like to go back?
Oh, gosh, I love the places I've been. I'm always up for going. I get some of the greatest invitations in the world, but sometimes there are places where it might be a little dangerous for me to go under certain circumstances. So there's some that I'd like to go to, which I haven't been to because of the political strife or things like that. But I'm always happy to go back to the Middle East, Dubai and Abu Dhabi. I love going to India very much. I love it. I would like to spend more time there. I actually have spoken two times in Pakistan, but remotely. So I've been invited there, but I'll have to kind of work out the details. But I've spoken there remotely, and I wouldn't mind visiting Pakistan, just have to work it out. I'd like to go back to pretty much all of them.
Well, Christina, we're about out of time, and I want to thank you so much for being here today, and also for your patience with our initial technical difficulties. And I just want to ask, is there any new obsession on the horizon for you?
Well, new obsession. I will admit, because it's a writer's show, I have a novel lingering around the edges of my consciousness. I do have a novel lingering. We'll see if it happens or not. I don't know.
All right.
But in the meantime, if people want to know where to get Camel Crazy, of course, I have my website. It's ChristinaAdamsAuthor.com. And then it's on Amazon. It's in any bookstore, Barnes & Noble, independent bookstores, wherever you can get it. And so I hope that if you like it, you let me know on social media. You can find me at Twitter at ChristinaThink, And I'm on Facebook at Christina Adams Author and Instagram at Christina Adams Author.
And Mom, do you have some closing words for us?
I do. We can't possibly know about all the natural things that can help medical conditions that are out there, but it's so wonderful to know that there are people who discover that they are available and then share that with the world. Thank you very much for doing that.
Thank you. That means a great deal to me. Thank you.
Thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Bye-bye.
Bye.